This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello everybody, from me.
And me.
Due to popular demand, this podcast is now being delivered to you in just one extra long chunk. How about that?
That's fantastic. That's what I demanded.
People were missing out on one of the two halves.
No!
They worked out how that... You know, they only got one half and they didn't get the other half. So now we're only creating one. So if you're expecting another part to this week's podcast, don't, because this is all you're getting.
So is it like watching Return of the King and The Two Towers together?
I don't know. All I'm saying is, this is it. You're about to hear the only bit of the podcast. Okay?
There's nothing else.
There's nothing else. Don't hang around waiting for the other part.
Okay, so when you've downloaded this bit...
There's nothing else.
That's it.
Until next week.
That really is all there is.
Thank you. Never ever thought it'd be a good idea to wear a moustache, and today I realise quite why that is the truth.
Yes.
You look preposterous and I look worse.
No, I don't look preposterous. I feel preposterous. The problem is
You look preposterous as well.
Mm. Have you ever actually rocked a moustache in real life?
Is that the same as grown one?
Yeah, but you know...
No.
No, you never rocked a fat one with a moustache. You've never tashed out. You've never stroked the upper.
Are you out furridge? Of
That's it.
Stroked the outer furridge.
Upper furridge.
Upper furridge is worse.
Yes. Have you ever done that? No.
No. I'm glad to say I have.
See,
not.
I can't grow a moustache because I've got a scar over this bit of my lip here. So there's a whole section that doesn't. So when I grow a tash, it goes down one side, but not the other. So it's. And that's the difference between me and some superior human beings who are able to grow a handsome tash.
We're live streaming, and so we can encourage that, although it would be slightly disturbing for viewers under 13, which gives us a PG rating. And we're doing it because Jason Isaacs has the most ludicrous moustache in Green Zone, which will be discussed after 2:30.
Do you feel the need to stroke your chin constantly? Because ever since you put that tash on, you've just been doing, a professor. Oh, yes, if we look over here, you've been doing a lot of chin stroking.
What I'm keen to do is just rip it off.
And start again.
Yes. That's a good song.
Thank you. Yes.
So Jason Isaacs will be with us from 2:30. He's in Los Angeles. For some reason, I'm sure he'll explain.
But his moustache is very much here.
That will
with
be.
Us.
And if you're listening last week, it's a slightly kind of strange thing that we did last week when it was live on the live streaming. As we were pre-recording the show to go out at 9 o'clock, you'll have heard Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass discussing the aforementioned moustache as being based on someone who is actually working on the film.
Yes. He happened to be moonlighting from the Village People.
So we'll give you the box office top 10 around about 2:15. So we'll count down to the
You're going to count down to the countdown
number one. Yes, it's countdown to the countdown. As I stroke my upper furridge live on the radio. Let me just do that. Now I mentioned this to Gabby. The most disturbing thing about this is that it said, as you probably saw from the makeup lady, on the thing from which you peel the moustache, made from real human hair.
Oh no!
Made in Korea. Yes. So this is probably plucked from a plug hole somewhere in a Seoul hotel.
Is this actually
it's
made
genuinely true? It's made with real human hair. I just hope they volunteered. That's all.
And I've been drinking my coffee through it. As indeed have you. I should say to the listening public that when we were down in makeup, having the tashes applied, you were throwing the most queenie hissy fit about not allowing them to put glue on your upper lip.
Now, what I wanted to
in case you weren't able to detach sufficient speed to get over to Radio 2 without losing your job.
Well, I have to get on the taxi bike immediately after the program.
Or the tashty bike in your case.
Tashty bike, very good. I have to rip it off and start again. Very good. So,
I can't drink this now that I know that it's somebody else's
you
hair.
You can't drink it through the filter of someone else's hair. No, that's probably true. Should we just forget that? Do you feel all kind of dirty?
I do. Although, as my friend Bob once said, you don't know nits until you've had them in your beard.
Jared in Boston, dear Doctors Phoebes and Caligari.
Caligari,
yes.
Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
During a recent
Phibes, incidentally.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Dear Doctors Phibes and Caligari, promising start. During a recent cold, I was prescribed a nasal spray to help relieve congestion. Unfortunately, I've only just noticed an alarming detail on the label. There, the product is described as, quote, 50 McG spray. Now that I know I've been taking 50 units of McG nasally for the past week, I'm a bit worried that a Vicus van der Merwe style transformation is going to occur. So, that's
Vicus van der Merwe, yes.
If I begin to show a proclivity for making flashy yet dull feature-length music video come-action movies, you'll be the first to know. That's Jared in Boston. MA, thank you. Dear Aladdin Jones, this is Russ in London. Mm-hmm. I wondered... He starts with things saying, thanks for a great show, but I never... unless it's got Steve on it, I don't think you can read that.
I'll say a bit about Aladdin Jones. I was on the Aladdin Jones show on Sunday.
I know, you're on everything.
Moving on.
Dear Aladdin Jones, I wondered if either of you had heard of Ram Gopal Varma's Phunk 2. Phonk 2.
No, I haven't.
A film apparently so scary that the director has offered a $10,000 reward for anyone who can watch the film alone in the cinema. Which is preposterous. Anyway. A camera watches the brave volunteer and makes sure their eyes stay open. The director offered the same deal in 2008 with the first film. Guess what that was called?
Was it Funk Un?
And the man who was...
Part Un.
Chosen after a selection process lasted 30 minutes before running out. Does Mark think he could handle it? And if he does, I assume I get half the money for suggesting it.
Yes. Loads on both counts.
You could sit through anything.
Exactly. I mean, so there are people who can sit... I tell you, a more scary prospect would see if you could sit through the new Jennifer Aniston movie and keep your eyes awake. I mean, that I would offer good money to see somebody do.
That'd be quite good. If anyone wants to arrange a screening for you and me to watch Funk 2...
Part 2.
We'll both sit through it.
And filmed
Ram Gopal Varma.
Okay.
We could watch that.
Yeah, fine.
Should we give the money to Sport Relief?
There we go.
Why don't we do that?
There we go.
A sponsored viewing.
What exactly is the sporting element of it from our end?
There is none. It was just the first charity to mind.
Okay, and we're not playing tennis anymore.
Well, I have to check that with Jason Isaacs. We're supposed to be playing tennis.
Well, we're supposed to be being ball boys whilst Jason Isaacs plays tennis.
If someone arranges that, we'll go and see it and give the money to Sport Relief.
Give the money to charity. Okay. Exactly.
Tony from Frodsham. Dear Kirk and Khan, I have a small offering for your subject of seeing more than one film in a day. Mm-hmm. Remember, it was just a couple of weeks back.
Yeah, I do. And can I just say before you go on, I wasn't complaining about seeing more than one film in a day. I consider it an honour and a privilege.
In 1992, two friends and I attended the Crosby Plaza Independent Cinema in Liverpool to watch Star Trek 1-6 through the night for charity. This equates to approximately 13 hours of Trek-tastic spacefaring adventure, and we achieved this by being sustained with full-fat Coke and chocolate. My abiding memory... the audience laughing heartily at the realisation that the footage of the Enterprise leaving space dock in Star Trek 2 was exactly the same as what we'd seen 1.5 hours earlier in Star Trek The Motion Picture. This included the waving man standing on the gantry and the upside-down astronaut floating about merrily.
But I don't know
why... They can't have used exactly the same
footage. I don't know why that would be surprising, considering that the TV show used exactly the same footage every time they docked at a new planet. Oh, docking on the planet Throng. That's interesting, because it looks like the planet Gadibble that you were in last week.
Finally, does the good doctor agree that as good as last year's Star Trek film was, it's second place behind the zenith of Star Trek film Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan?
No, I still think the best Star Trek film is The Voyage Home, which I really enjoyed enormously and had the right amount of the right mix of humour and you know, proper sci-fi stuff.
If we have any listeners in Korea, can I just... say, if anyone knows about the moustache industry...
Are you going to ask for the hair back?
Well, no, I'm just concerned that someone has been exploited and that this isn't fairly traded moustache, you know, that actually it was just ripped from the head of some poor peasant as they went past, or, as I say, plucked from the plug holes of a shower in a hotel.
Why do you have to keep saying it? Why do you have to keep saying plug holes?
Increasingly concerned. Conrad K, BA Honours, English Language and Literature, dear Wesley and Buttercup, wanted to drop a quick note to tell Dr. K how much I've enjoyed his new book. Have you got a book out?
I have got a book out, Simon.
You should do
it. That's the only bit of it that you've read.
You should do a bit of promotion for that. You should try and get on a few shows.
The Alan Jones Show. I love the show, Steve.
I haven't got to the religious significance.
Shall I rub my moustache against the microphone? I've just realised there are some people who can't see the moustaches. Okay. This is the sound of freshly...
You're not going to rub your upper
human
furage.
Hair. I'm going to rub my upper furage against... You ready for this?
That just sounds disgusting. There's some poor bald peasant in Korea who's
going,
that's my hair.
I recognise my hair.
Wanted to drop a quick note to tell Dr. K how much I enjoyed his book. I bought it in the knowledge that I was soon to be poolside in Miami and would need some good reading. In essence, I was saving it, but I allowed myself a glance at the prologue. What harm could that do? By the end of the day, it was finished, as if those little diagrammatic chainsaws were chasing me through the pages. A breakneck, pan-global ride through a film-obsessive life, an odyssey of smashed-up vans, punched faces, and dodgy Eastern European accents. Does it worry the auteur that his life has all the elements to un film de Guy Ritchie? Thoroughly entertaining. Keep up the bickertainment.
No, I now I'm a big Guy Ritchie fan. You haven't read it yet, have you? You've only read the bit you're in.
Well, that's the only bit that I had to approve. I read the first 30 pages and I really, really enjoyed it.
And then you read the bit that you're in and then you gave up.
Yeah, well,
you're some friend, you are.
Who said this? Okay, this is on an email from Hui Chong in Singapore.
Okay.
He sends this quote. I don't like 3D. I don't believe there is any film that I have ever seen and loved that would have been improved a scintilla in 3D. To me, it's just a gimmick. I don't believe that Citizen Kane or Gone with the Wind or any damn picture that you can name will be better off in 3D. I think it's a gimmick. He's repeating himself. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of what happened when CinemaScope came in, when everyone predicted that every picture was going to be made in CinemaScope, because it's not that way. It was meant to get people out of the house. I find 3D distracting. I'm in the minority, I know.
So that'll, if you're saying who said it, presumably it'll be a historical quote. It'll be from somebody in the...
No, it's someone who's around now.
Somebody around now. Well, obviously it chimes with what I was saying, but it must be like Roger Ebert or Anthony Lane or somebody, because it won't be me. It wouldn't be quoting me to me.
It sounds as though it's you, though, doesn't it?
It does, but who is it?
William Friedkin.
Oh, well, there we go.
There you go.
I'm seeing Billy next week. That's fantastic. I'm going to... So I shall embrace him warmly on that subject.
By the way, if, says Hui Chong, if there is indeed a Kermode and Mayo world tour, please add Singapore into your itinerary.
We can do that.
We should definitely do.
I think we should
We'd
do...
We'd be in trouble if we both arrived.
I think we should do
though.
Taking the hair home. I think we should go...
Go back to
Korea. Go back to Korea.
On a search.
With
this is
the
a,
hair.
This
to
is
find
a BBC
the people
4 documentary.
Whose hair we have stolen.
We came in search
of the hair.
Dear Werner and Klaus, I recently read an interview with Werner Herzog in a German newspaper in which the interviewer referred to the infamous shooting incident in LA a few years back and remarked that the Meister himself stayed rather calm in that particular situation. Herzog confirmed this, but added that the BBC people...
were sucking and cowering and running away like the cowards they are!
...seemed to have had, shall we say, an accident. Did you, Doctor, indeed, have an accident?
No, I have an accident. I had a screaming fit. It's all on the... It's on the bit, as I said. And every time Herzog tells this story, if he's now saying we had an accident, every time he tells this story, he gets braver and we get more and more cowardly. To the point that the way he tells it now, there's virtually a machine gun, you know, firing at him with him taking incoming fire while we duck and cower.
This is from Robert Luck in Hamburg, who says, anyway, since in last week's programme there were people from all over the world inviting you to their strange and exotic places to continue your book promotion tour, I'd like to take the opportunity to officially ask you to visit good old Germany on behalf of your German fan base. I know it's not exactly Shanghai or Wellington, New Zealand, but at least we can provide you with the latest Bavarian accents available to perfect your Werner Herzog impersonation. Also, as I am an English teacher, I can bring all my pupils to buy your book.
Excellent. Well, we had a great time in Berlin, didn't we? I stood on top of the tower where, you know, Wings of Desire was, where the angels are.
Peter in Runswick Bay...
I know there are other things that tower's famous for, but...
Dr. Kermode looks alarmingly like Stalin.
And I take that as a compliment in a weird way.
Dear Gringo...
Stalin wasn't stalling when he told the Beast of Berlin that they'd never rest contented till they had driven him from the land.
What was that for?
Stalin wasn't stalling.
Andy McGregor says, dear Gringo and scum-sucking pig, is one of you going to suddenly say, bring me the head of Alfredo Garcia? It looks like you are. Anyway, we've got to do the box office top 10 because Jason's going to be joining us tashless. He's tashless and we're tash.
Has he definitely shaved
it off? What do you think,
Lindsay? I like it. You could be extras in Brokeback Mountain.
Did you see how she did that?
I know, that's very good. Nicely worked in. Marilyn Monroe, says Eloise. Marilyn Monroe once said, kissing a man without a moustache is like eating an egg without salt. We're live stream, so you can see Mark look like Stalin. Oh, I just think mine smells of beef.
You look.
I think the person who volunteered their hairs was eating beef just before.
What, with his head? Eating beef through the top of his head. I don't think the fact that it's human hair. I don't think it's human tash hair. I think it's human hair.
Well, yeah.
No, but not. It wouldn't work very well if you were shaving human hair to make a tash, to make a stick-on tash. What you do is, as
it's
you
getting
said,
worse,
you
Mark.
just cut somebody's hair off and then make several tashes out of
it. Yes, it's getting worse. Box office top 10 ahead of Jason, joining us from Los Angeles. At 10, A Single Man.
Which I like very much. And, you know, we all knew that Colin Firth wasn't going to win the Oscar. Doesn't make any difference. A very fine performance. Very good film. And I do still think that if people hadn't known who Tom Ford was, they wouldn't have been quite so catty about his fashion background. Although, one of the interesting moments at the Oscars ceremony, did you see that very, very torturous gag about... when they had Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin introducing Tom Ford and somebody else, and they said, and now to present the next award to a pair of famous fashion whores. And then Alec Baldwin went, horses, fashion horses, clothes horses. And it was, And then Tom Ford came on, and I have to say the look on his face was not one of, oh, what a funny joke. It was of, yeah, come on. You can do so much better than that. And I agreed with him.
So was it not good?
It was pretty average. You know, apparently they got very good viewing figures, but I'm surprised because it was pretty boring.
Anyway, Single Man at 10, Valentine's Day at 9.
Terrible. Just terrible. Greeting card full of sick. Awful. Painful.
And there is a fine pair of films, because Valentine's Day at 9, Leap Year at 8.
Now, Leapy Ear.
Anna Pickering in York. Dear, while you were sleepless in Seattle, regarding very Simon's good comments 2 weeks ago about Leapy Ear,
yes,
and how its target audience was that of a younger and different gender to yourselves, I'd just like to put forward, as a member of that demographic,
but I disagree with you,
that I have no desire to see this film whatsoever, mainly because, like The Good Doctor, I first saw this film when I saw the trailer,
mm-hmm,
and that was what put me off entirely. It's not that I have anything against romantic comedies. Enjoying something fluff and fun once in a while is healthy.
Try a moustache.
But like any film genre, I like it when it is done well. I am sick of the Jennifer Aniston, Kate Hudson type filler that we keep getting, which is largely filled of the female lead embarrassing herself through pratfalls, being so tightly wound up that there's a generic getting drunk karaoke scene with a love interest and a soundtrack jammed with the latest pop hits, as we say in DJ land. Please, 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 all filmmakers, make these films better, because I'm sick and tired of seeing, or at least seeing, trailers for third-rate romantic comedies. Not all of us who are younger and female are of the Sex and the City ilk, in which was to be blinded by the sight of pretty shoes and handbags, and will watch anything as long as the leading man is good-looking. You are failing the audience. Now, my only query, Anna Pickering in York, is that you seem to have sent that email based on the trailer. Now, I know you said last week that the trailer essentially is
the film.
But if you're going to slag it off, I think you really do have to see the film.
You're only saying that because you and I saw it and you want everyone else to suffer. You don't see why anyone else should get off lightly.
But in general, if you're going to you have to see the film.
Yes, you have to see the film. I agree with that. Although, to be honest with you, if she'd seen the film, she would have come up with a good... But yes, that's absolutely true. A point that I have made several times, it's not that I've got anything against rom-coms. I just have something against the fairly dismal level of rom-coms we've all had to endure, particularly recently in the wake of the astronomical success of the Sex and the City movie, which was ghastly and was a film where, you know, with a handbag where its heart should be.
We have Percy Jackson, The Lightning Thief, Benjamin Snittlegrass, and
The Cauldron of Penguins.
There it is, at number 7.
Well, the Benjamin Snittlegrass thing seems to have legs all of its own, and appears to be now an entire movie entertainment industry. I suspect that the Percy Jackson and The Lightning Thief saga is not going to run in the same way that Benjamin Snittlegrass may well do, because it's just frankly not that good. I mean, it's, you know, it's got some special effects in it, but it's Chris Columbus doing his bean counting thing, and I don't know why, if you were Chris Columbus, you'd feel good about putting your name to this. Regardless of my reservations about the first two Harry Potter movies, more of which I'm sure Jason will put me right on in just a second, I just don't know why you'd do Percy Jackson. It's one of those things. It's like, I'm trying to think of a band analogy. No, I can't. I know what it's like. It's like being in Sweet, right? And then leaving in Sweet and joining Shiwadi Wadi. But not quite.
That was really worth it.
Thank you.
That was worth going for. From Paris with Love is at number 6.
Which, you know, continues the downward trend once again of John Travolta's career. He was up, he was down, he was up again, and now he appears to be on the way back down again. It's a really boring action movie with massive amounts of shooting and explosion, which should be an awful lot more fun than it is. And watching it, it was just that. Don't crack your fingers while I'm reviewing the films.
It relieved the tedium. Oh, very nice.
Boring and not good. And here's an example of how boring it is that there's a point in which basically John Travolta makes a joke about his role in Pulp Fiction, which is the point that you need to head for the door.
Princess and the Frog at 5.
Which I like very much. Good old-fashioned animation, well-drawn. I like the story more than some people. It's got a proper villain who's genuinely scary. I think the songs are pretty impressive, and how terrific to see, you know, proper animation holding its own against more modern forms.
The Lovely Bones at 4.
Have you seen this yet?
Nope.
Are you going to?
Nope.
No. Do you know you don't feel impelled to?
Nope. Should I?
Well, no, there's an interesting thing that... No, I don't mean no, you shouldn't see it. Last week somebody wrote in...
Why did you say no then?
it was a rhetorical no. Last week, somebody wrote in to say, you know, the BBFC's 12 certificate, how did they arrive at that? And I advised everybody to go to the BBFC website and have a look on bbfc.co.uk and have a look at their ruling, which is very, very well explained. I was asked by my daughter whether she could see Lovely Bones, and I said no. It's, you know, because not because there's anything, it is harrowing subject matter, and I understand why it's 12 certificate, but it's one of those movies in which you'd have to think very clearly about allowing somebody on 12 certificate, despite the fact that all the heaven stuff looks like Super Mario, and that's a big problem. But I do think it's an honourable failure, and when Floyd and Boyd were on and they really kicked seven bells out of it, I don't feel as harshly towards it as that, because I do feel that it fails honourably, but I would like to have seen what Lynn Ramsey would have made of it.
The Crazies at 3?
It's, funnily enough, is much more satisfying than you expect. It has none of the political nous of the original. It has none of the sociological nous of the original. Again, I quoted Nigel Floyd before when, you know, he said that the original was about people killing each other and the remake is about the army killing everyone, which is kind of slightly less scary. But it does still have a nihilistic element to it, which I think is played up rather nicely. And it zips along in a crowd-pleasing way. I think it clearly won't last in the way that the original did. You're not going to look at the remake of The Crazies in 10 years' time and go, that was really important. But I did enjoy it.
Avatar is at 2. We know all about that. It's no longer at number 1. And let's do some correspondence on Alice in Wonderland, which is the box office number 1.
Can I say, just before you do the correspondence, can I just say, having seen the preview in 3D and complained about the 3D, I went to the cinema over the weekend and I paid to see it in 2D. And I'll tell you this, it is so much better in 2D. And it still has the same problems that it has, you know, as far as the, in the end, all the parts don't add up to that much. Please stop fondling your moustache because I can't concentrate. No, don't do that. That's even weirder. Stroking it is weirder than fondling it and flicking it.
And flicking the flappy bits.
You're clicking your fingers and playing with your moustache, but it's much, much, much better in 2D, much more satisfying experience, and clearly designed to be seen in 2D.
Ben Ski. Anyway, having ruined Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, my kids just found it weird compared to the original. I wasn't expecting much from Tim Burton's latest effort at trying to make a great children's story feel like a film for adults. That aside, what is Mark going on about when he says Alice in Wonderland lacks the substance of something like Edward Scissorhands? That film was pants and tops let me finish the email. That film was pants and tops my all-time films I couldn't recommend to my worst enemy list.
Edward Scissorhands?
Yes, Edward Scissorhands.
I'm
twitching.
I'm genuinely speechless.
Vicky in Glasgow. I so wanted to like Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland, but sadly this was a terribly flat film. Quite a feat, considering it's in 3D. What with Helena Bonham Carter channeling Miranda Richardson's Queenie and Johnny Depp growling his way through his lines like an extra from Taggart, I expected him to say, there's been a murder, at any moment. I had such high expectations for this film. Burton's track record promised a dark, edgy, gothic take on a classic story, but this just didn't work. I can't help thinking Tim Burton's vision had been Disneyfied. The one high point, Stephen Fry's Cheshire Cat, which we previewed last week, hitting a wonderfully menacing tone, giving a hint of darkness that was missing from the rest of the film. It was just bland.
Yeah, I thought it's better than that. I think it's certainly not top flight Burton by any means. I think there are a lot of things wrong with it. A couple of people have written into the blog saying, you know, I have a problem being able to criticise Tim Burton. And even when Tim Burton makes a film that's as bad as something that Quentin Tarantino makes, I kind of forgive him for it because I sort of like Tim Burton. It is undoubtedly true that I am sympathetic towards Tim Burton. But I do think there are things wrong with Alice, but I have now seen it twice. And believe me, second time round, 2D, it's a much better film.
This is the most interesting one. I'll finish on this. Jenny from London. First email for you. I thought I would raise the question of Alice. I went to see it in 3D over the weekend and in some ways would agree with Mark about his views on both Alice and 3D in general. But having heard Mark speak many times about the lack of good role models in movies for young girls, I thought he would have been overjoyed by Alice. This is the story of a young girl who doesn't want to wear the silly fashion clothes her mother wants her to. No corsets for her. She doesn't want the ideal of marriage, unlike Leap Year. No, she runs off and she makes her own destiny, doing her own thing by her own rules. She doesn't do what everyone says that she should. No, she rescues her friend instead, is quick, sensible, and is still pretty. The end is also great, which for the first in a very long time, I watched a brave young woman in armour. Again, sensible looking armour with trousers as well. Yes. And wins the day and saves the world. Go her, I say.
Who's that email from?
from?
Jenny in London.
100% agree with everything that you said. I'm sorry if I didn't actually say, I thought that I had said that, but you are completely right. And I took my daughter and she loved it. And I thought exactly all those things. It's, as Philip K. Dick said when he saw the rough cut of Blade Runner, it's as if you looked inside my head.
Final email, final paragraph from Jenny. If I knew a young girl, I would be dragging her to this movie first opportunity, because in a world where wearing a big dress...
In a world where wearing a big dress...
And getting married seems to be the goal of many a movie heroine. This one is brave, intelligent, sensible and great.
I agree 100%.
You can email mail at bbc.co.uk. You can text 85058. You can watch online. It's Tashtastic. What we want to know is whether Jason Isaacs still has his on.
This from David in North Yorkshire. Just looked at the webcam. Simon Mayo in profile with Tash is Gary Oldman.
I'll settle for that.
Really?
That's good. You're Stalin, I'm Gary Oldman.
Together
That's not
at
bad.
Last.
Together at last, indeed. This is Five Live. I'm Gary Oldman. He's Joseph Djoujashvili. That's his name. And we're live streaming. We're awaiting the arrival of Jason Isaacs. Basically, what we want to do, he's going to be in the studio in Los Angeles.
Yes. He's not there.
He's not there yet, but we'll know he's there when a voice says, hello, I'm Jason Isaacs.
Isaacs.
That's what we're waiting for. Dear Cheech and Chong, says Lee in Bedford. First time listening live in over a year. Watching you both is very similar to a cheesy spaghetti western. Keep up the good work. Edward at work in London. As a first-time viewer, I actually believed for a second that Simon had grown an actual moustache. That was till I saw Mark and knew it must be this week's gag. I think you have to say it like that. After last week's Greengrass and Damon interview, I missed out on as I listened to the podcast. Mark looks as though he could easily play the pilot in Up in the Air. Great show and great book, he says.
Steve.
Dear Matt and Damon, if neither of you guys says, my name is Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die by the end of the show, then those poor Korean men will truly have shaved in vain. That's very good. These moustaches are driving us mad. And when that Isaacs guy comes on the line,
they're going straight off. They are itchy, itchy.
This from Craig. Simon, I just discovered the pleasure that is your podcast in a now almost certainly past its use-by date response to your bit about the fella from Coffs Harbour who saw five movies in one day. I contribute my time at an Andy Warhol festival in my youth, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. and included Flesh for Frankenstein, Blood for Dracula, Trash, Lonesome Cowboys, Flesh, and at this point I can't remember anymore. Writing this down has made me remember the rather lovely dark film, was it Basquiat. So it wasn't all for nothing. I do still long for a bit of Warhol on a cold winter's night. You're probably the same. So many classic moments. So he thinks, this is Craig, an Aussie like the cinematically starved Coffs fellow. So he basically filled 11 till 10 with non-stop Andy Warhol.
The thing I've never seen I've seen bits of it, is the Andy Warhol Empire State, which is the shot of the Empire State Building with the skyline.
24 hours, isn't it?
Well, that's alleged. Has anyone actually seen it? I mean, I know it's an installation, but has anyone actually seen it? And is it really 24 hours?
Is it the film where the only action is the lights going on?
Yes, that's right. But it's one of those things, as I said, I haven't actually seen it, so far be it for me to review a film I haven't actually seen. Has anyone actually seen it? Is it really, or is it just that it's on a loop? I'm starting to wonder whether this might be a modern myth about Empire State being 24 hours long. I'm not certain that it's true.
Do you think that there are some films that actually you don't need to see, but you can review them anyway?
No.
I'm thinking of Bounty Hunter.
No, I've seen Bounty Hunter.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, no, never review a film you haven't seen. I've seen Bounty Hunter, and believe me, it's coming out next week, and I'm going to be in New York next week in the studio that Jason Isaacs is currently failing to be in, but I am going to review Bounty Hunter from across the Atlantic, and boy, do I have a few things to say about it.
And while we're waiting for plug A to fit into socket B, let's start some reviews, and I think we're going to go with a Richard Gere favourite.
Hachi... A Dog's Tale, also called A Dog's Life, you know, depending on which territory, and over here, A Dog's Tale. It's so exciting on so many different fronts. One, it's a Richard Gere movie. Two, it's a dog movie. And I love both Richard Gere and dogs. When I went to the screening, I sat there next to James King, who twittered as the lights went down, Mark Kermode is exceptionally excited about this film. Because he said to me, you're excited about this. I said, I'm really, because I genuinely really, really like Richard Gere movies. And I genuinely, because you've seen the poster. Have you seen the poster? Richard Gere.
Yeah, he's got his U certificate smile on.
Yeah, he's got his U certificate smile on, and the dog has got its, you know, all cutest dog. And that. So anyway, it looks very cute. Now, there's a couple of problems. It's based on a true story, you know, inspired by real events. There's a dog in the early 1930s, an Akita dog named Hachiko. Tokyo Station. The story is that he had his master, okay, and he was very, very loyal to his master, and one day his master didn't come back because his master had died, but the dog would still go to the station to wait for the master to get off the train. Okay, heartbreaking story, apparently very, very well known, very sort of honoured in Japan. Okay, so now what we get is the Americanized version, and I have to tell you straight away that in the press notes it says that one of the reasons that Richard Gere was so great for this role, in which essentially he plays, you know, he's an American professor who gets a dog by mistake. A dog is being shipped somewhere by mistake, ends up on a platform. Richard, who is big-hearted, takes the dog in, doesn't remember, and then the dog then follows Richard to the station. Okay, they said Richard Gere was the perfect choice for this role because of his love for animals and nature, and especially because of his connection to the Tibetan Buddhists and his quest for peace. These sorts of things are very important. Gere felt similarly about the Akita dogs that play Hachiko. These are not the kind of dogs you can buy with treats, he said. They either like you or you don't, and Akita makes a connection or it doesn't. Akitas are very discerning and particular dogs, and as Gere recalls, the trainers were very apprehensive about me meeting the dogs because these dogs make up their mind right away, and if they don't like you, there's no going back.
That just sounds like nonsense.
No, basically, the scene is set for an epic confrontation between Richard Blinky Gere and a cute dog.
We've got the clip, by the way.
Have we got the clip?
Yeah.
So this is basically the clip when Richard, he's come by the dog, you know, he's found it on a platform and he's been forced to take it on. He doesn't want to. His wife doesn't want him to have it. He's trying to get rid of it, but he's actually discovering as he's trying to get rid of the dog that there are interesting things about that chime with his personality both on and off the screen. Oh. Here's a chiming clip.
No ordinary dog, Parker.
No.
It's a Akita, or Akita, as you say. It's a very special breed.
Yeah. Mm. What is that?
Hachi.
What?
It's a Japanese for eight, number of good fortune.
Oh, good fortune. Oh, very nice. Hachi. Hachi. Oh, that's a good name. I like that.
Well, he might have been born eighth in the litter. Spiritual significance, the number eight reaches up to heaven, comes down to earth.
So what do you think? You want him?
Me? No, I think he's made his choice.
Meaning what?
Well, meaning he's your problem, not mine, brother.
You're not a problem, are you?
Well, whether you found him or he found you, who's to say? Had to be.
Now, it would be very easy to mock.
Yeah, that was a bit dull, I thought.
What? Really?
That whole clip was a bit dull.
That was one of the more exciting moments. Wasn't it?
Really?
It's unfilmed.
Doesn't bode well, does it?
It's unfilmed the Lasse Hallström, and it would be very easy to mock.
Lasse Hallström. Lasse's just a good name.
Oh, I see. Lasse Hallström, yeah. Because it's a dog's tail. Do you see what you did there? You made his name sound like a dog.
Yeah, but you've just picked up the comedic crowbar. And you've battered
that joke into submission. Okay.
I can't smile too much because my face
will
crack.
Face will
still
fall
waiting
off. Okay.
For Jason Isaacs to say hello, I'm Jason Isaacs.
Here's both the triumph and the problem with Hachi, a dog's tail. As I was watching at the beginning, I thought, this is lovely. It's lovely, right? It's Richard Gere doing the thing that he does, which is being avuncular now. He's very good. Since he's gone grey, he's become terrifically avuncular. And he avuncles really
so
well.
So presumably he doesn't drop his trousers in this film?
No. Well, he hasn't dropped his trousers since Chicago.
I hope you're not talking about me. Good evening, gentlemen.
Jason Isaacs, as I live and breathe. Thank the good Lord for that.
We were locked, but we weren't bonded, apparently. But we were connected, but we hadn't zapped.
Stay where you are, Mr. Isaacs. I just wonder, were you going to conclude here on
Do you mind? Jason, do you have to dash off or can you stay?
Absolutely not.
Fine.
I'm here
okay,
forever.
So, since I'm in the Richard Gere moment, okay, so let me do it. So the thing is, as I was saying, you know, he does have a sort of charming grey-haired avuncular quality, which I really like. And I'm sitting there watching the thing, thinking, this is really nice. It's Joan Allen, who's a terrific actress. It's Richard Gere, who I just love watching, despite the fact that all he ever does is blinks and exhales. And it's cute dog. And I'm thinking, great, take the kids along. You know,
he just blinks and exhales.
That's all he does. That's it. It's his whole
acting. He squints as well.
Yeah, squints, blinks and exhales. That's what he does. That's what Richard Gere did. But okay, fine. Don't be.
That's depth. That's depth.
That is depth.
Actor.
Yeah. Sometimes he does it together, and that's real depth. But then what's
happening? Could he do it while jumping out of a helicopter?
I'm sure he could. If you compare this to Marley and Me, which is an absolutely horrible film, which, as I said, is less fun than having a real dog put down, this is a masterpiece. This is Citizen Kane. This is all the things that Marley and Me isn't. But the problem with it is that it's saccharine sweet and lovely in a kid's film. But since I didn't know anything about the story of Hachiko before I went in to see the film, I didn't know that the story of one man and his dog has not one, but two tragic denouements. So what I would say about it is this. Although it's very, very easy to mock, the main problem with it is that if you're going to take along, you know, young kids who are sensitive, as I was planning to do, please be aware that there are two. I mean, I was in floods. Genuinely in floods.
But that doesn't mean
twice.
Anything.
No, no, but it does mean something. And I was in floods for two reasons. Firstly, because when the first tragic thing happened, I thought, oh, well, that's
okay. It's a spoiler.
I thought, no, I'm not going to say what it is.
Of course,
thought,
it's a spoiler. Obviously, there are dogs dying all over the place.
No, 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 clearly. That's not it.
People are dead.
That's not right.
People die.
Well, okay.
I'm guessing. I haven't seen the film.
Yeah,
it's not a spoiler because I'm guessing.
Put it this way.
It's not the dropping the share price, is
in
it?
In the case of Marley and Me, right, had what happens in... I'm trying so hard not to give this away. All I'm saying
well,
is
you've
this.
Failed.
If you're... No, I haven't, because you don't know what it is that happens. If you're a parent and you fancy taking your kid to a movie that's got Richard Gere and cute dogs in it, please be aware that
one
both
of them doesn't make it to the end.
No, it's not. No, it's not that one of them doesn't make it to the end, Simon.
Okay,
no. Okay,
maybe.
Okay, so all I'm saying is
apocalyptic.
It's an apocalypse. So there's a total apocalypse. It's a dog apocalypse. It's dog apocalypse pow. Okay, dog apocalypse bow wow is what it is. That's actually what we should call it. Dog apocalypse bow wow. And so, despite the fact that Richard is blinking and exhaling and being grey in a way which I really like, and despite the fact that, frankly, I will watch almost any movie in which cute dogs are cute, because, you know, I just love dogs, I just was thinking, I so wish... But, having said that...
Yes?
I like... This is clearly the centre of the story. The story is, because this is why Richard is suited for it, because he's such a Buddhist, it's a story about devotion. And it is a story which... You know, we were talking about the depiction of heaven in Lovely Bones? It is a story
vaguely.
in which the afterlife, shall we say, is invoked. It's invoked quite heavily. The afterlife is invoked because there
now
is...
Now I'm picturing Richard and a dog skipping down a heavenly beach after they've been wiped out by some terrible disaster.
And, you know, the funny thing is that actually that scene wouldn't be out of place in Archie, a dog's... And now that you say it, I'm sure Lasser is beating his head in the wall thinking, why didn't I think of that? So what I'm saying is, it's not terrible. It's just heartbreaking.
Oof. Right.
That was good.
That's if you apply the Marley and Me test.
No, the Marley and Me thing is vomit-inducing.
By which standard, most films come out quite well.
No, and also, in the case of Marley and Me, I would frankly be happy if they'd all been put down in the first 5 minutes and we just got on with watching another film. That's the thing. That's the point.
David in Leeds say, all that one can say about watching the live streaming with added furage is that it has moved Wittertainment past camp and into a territory so highly disturbing and threatening it makes The Exorcist look like Pingu. So, this is all in your honour, Mr. Isaac, sir.
I wish I was there. I can't tell you how I almost rode home, but I'm 6,000 miles away. But I did get out of bed at dawn, and I'm
well, we appreciate that. We're inspired by your by the appearance of your tash in Green Zone.
Oh, you're wearing moustaches, eh?
We are. Have you not seen the photographs?
We've sent you a picture.
We've sent you a picture. Turn your phone on.
Turn your phone on.
Oh,
we won't mind if it goes and all that. We've sent you... You're in the picture. I'm in the picture.
I'm in the picture.
Fantastic.
We're all
tashed
up.
It's not arrived yet, but I can't wait for it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and it's all in your honour, and boy, does it hurt. So, first of all, the most important thing, just tell us about the moustache that you're wearing in the
film. I'll tell you what happened. Is that Paul Greengrass was... he's an old mate of mine. He was already making this film. I knew he was off in Morocco, and he called me one night and said, what are you doing? And I said, nothing. I'm watching telly. Why aren't you making your film? He said, yeah. What are you doing tomorrow? I said, no, what do you mean? He said, do you want to jump out of a helicopter and beat the crap out of Matt Damon? And I said, in what sense? And he said...
In what sense?
Yeah. I think that was quite a good description.
Yeah, he said, well, there's a part in my film. You know, I'm using mostly real soldiers and real people and just a few actors, but it's a Special Forces soldier. I don't know what the part's going to be. I was going to use one of the real Special Forces guys, but I talked to them all today, and I'm not quite sure that there might be a little bit more acting than they manage. So he said, it's a poison chalice. You can tell me to sod off if you like. We've got no money. I don't know. You've got to start tomorrow morning, and I'd only be here for a few weeks. But bring the kids. It's half term. So I went and spoke to my missus, and I jumped on a plane. I went to the set the next morning in Morocco, and before I went down to see him and say hello, I went to the makeup trailer to kind of come up with a look. And there are all these Iraqi moustaches laid out there, because all Iraqis
you
have
had
moustaches.
An Iraqi one? Ours are both
no,
Korean.
No, I cut them up,
oh, right,
and
okay.
I made a little kind of Fu Manchu thing, and I stuck it on almost for a joke. Not quite, but half for a joke. Put a uniform on, went out of the set so that Paul could have a look, and he kind of tilted his head quizzically, and he said, I can't swear on your programme, but he said, what...
Well, you have twice already, so if you could avoid
really
a third.
Crappy swearing.
There's that trick.
I'll stop now. He said, what the asterisk is that? And I said, it's a moustache, mate. They all have special forces, in my most serious voice. So, you know, like a doctor or something. And he kind of, he was on the verge, I'm sure, of ripping it off my face. He said, let's try it. Jump on a helicopter. And he called the first assistant over. He said, change the scene. Put Jason on a helicopter. And I panicked. You know, my throat went dry. And I've really just gone out of the set to say hello and show him the costume. And 15 minutes later, we flew around the city. I lost 3 stone in fear, and I was jumping off the helicopter and beating up Matt Damon. So that's how it came about. It was almost a joke, and the great thing was that night we're in a restaurant, and we're all laughing about the moustache, and a bloke came over who was security for the whole film, and he had big moustache on. He'd be 70, he was 17 years Special Forces. He leant over, he went, I've got a moustache just the same. I was Special Forces. And we all kind of nodded grimly, and that was it. No one made fun of it again until today.
So the scene where we see you for the first time, where you do indeed jump out of the helicopter, and it took me about 30 seconds before I realised it was you, to be perfectly honest.
That's the idea. It's all pretend, isn't it?
So that scene, and there where you confront Matt Damon for the first time, you just thought you were there for a jolly and taking the kids for half term.
I promise you, I got on the helicopter, and Paul said to me, just get off the helicopter. Matt's got some prisoners. Take him. Get back on the helicopter. If he gets in your way, squash him like a bug. And I went, well, just give me something slightly more specific than that. He said, that's not how I work, mate. And I got on the helicopter with a bunch of guys who I ended up being very friendly with, but these real Special Forces guys just back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I said, over the noise of the blades, I went, what would I say? And they went, can't hear you. And I jumped off the plane, and there was one of the world's biggest movie stars, and I just rubbed his face in the donkey dirt.
Yeah.
So it was fun.
So he suffered a lot more than you did.
He actually did end up, I'm not joking, the first day that I met him, the first day that we shot that scene, black and blue and lots of kind of scrapes and cuts all over him. And every time I was embarrassed to do it, and he just went, go for it. Do what you've got to, make it look real. And although Paul's an old friend of mine, I hadn't seen him work for a long time. When we last worked together, he used to do traditional filming, you know, with the dollies and marks and stuff. And what he does now is make everything as real and exciting as possible and try and capture it as if he's a documentary filmmaker. So there was no kind of cotton wool pads or faking things. It was amazing.
Other than the moustache, which is stick-on.
Which is ludicrous. Well, it was stick-on. No, I grew one, because otherwise I couldn't move my mouth.
So we continue with Jason Isaacs, the other side of the news. You can send us an email. It's mayo@bbc.co.uk. You can text 85058. And during the news, we're going to blow our tashes because it's a very entertaining thing to do. Mark's here. I'm here. Jason Isaacs is in LA. Is that because you got a call? Something else?
I'm working here doing stuff.
And, what? What are you doing?
I'm shooting a pilot for Rupert Murdoch. No, I'm shooting a pilot for Fox. I've gone the way of all of my contemporaries and decided to dip my toe into American television.
Are you there next week, Jason?
Up in Chicago next week. That's where we shoot it. Why are you coming?
Yeah, I'm going to come to LA, but you're going to be in Chicago. That's a total waste of time.
So sorry.
Steve in Northampton. Jason's disembodied voice seems like you're talking to God on the streaming. Most
in so many ways.
Paul on this saw Green Zone last night, as expected. Brilliant, even better once you remind yourself that Matt Damon is not Jason Bourne, which I only realised after he got beaten up by Jason Isaacs. Because that has to be... If that was Bourne that you were taking on, he'd have accounted for himself slightly better, wouldn't he?
Oh, Bourne could, with a bit of sticky-back plastic and a ballpoint pen, take out 100 ninjas, yeah. No, Matt's mortal in this. I mean, I think that Paul Greengrass, the director, has done something amazing. He's kind of married that, the high-octane thrills of the Bourne movies that he's made with those other films he makes, United 93 and Bloody Sunday. And all the people I know in the film business said he couldn't do it, said it wasn't possible to give people a big blockbuster, kind of popcorn-munching thrill ride, and also make the subject matter the stuff of real life. And my experience watching it with American audiences is he's more than pulled it off. But so few people have that ambition in filmmaking. It's an extraordinary thing.
When you say pulled it off, it just makes me want to pull this
moustache
off.
I know, because it is incredibly in the
it's getting worse.
We have got
That's why I grew my own in the end.
We have got a clip of you and slightly me, Simon, talking to Paul and Matt about Jason. Right, I don't know whether he's heard it.
Oh, really? I have. It's on your podcast. You know that I'm addicted to your podcast.
And so you've heard the podcast. There's no point.
It's just a cue line. We're going to play it anyway.
Okay. Play it anyway.
All right, here we go. And so much to enjoy in the film, including Jason Isaacs' Village People-style moustache. That was a charmer, wasn't it?
It was a hell of a moustache. To Jason's credit, one of the Special Forces guys who worked security for the set while we were shooting had that exact moustache. So literally that exact mustache. It was as if Jason had taken the mustache off of his face and put it on his own. So it was authentic, which was always Jason's kind of first, and all of his energy went into authenticity. It was a particular
thrill to see the credits at the end and Jason Isaacs. I mean, I thought that was as close as you got to saying "and hello" to Jason Isaacs as I've ever actually seen on a movie credit. Very good.
he's a great bad guy, isn't he?
There you go. We're singing your praises, aren't we? It's non-stop.
It's very nice. But the reason it says "and Jason Isaacs," of course, is that the film was already cast and filming. And like I said, my mate called me up and said, "Pop out for a few weeks." Now, I was there for 9 months.
I've got a query about that because you said you're very kind of casual about your role and it was just very last minute and so on. But when people go and see the film, they will come out and think, "How is that possible?" Because you know you are there to the end of the film.
Yeah.
You're quite a crucial character right the way to the closing sequence.
Well, I'll tell you how that is.
Hang on. We should say rather more clearly that actually both you and I, in conversation with Jason Simon, were told by Jason, "Oh, I'm in it, but I'm hardly in it at all." And then we saw it. You're clearly in it all the time.
And you were afraid you were going to end up on the cutting room floor. Yeah. I can't see how that's going to be happening because you're the most important person in the film apart from Matt.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. Of course, I'm the only person whose phone number you've got as well. But the reason that I thought that is because Paul makes films in this extraordinary organic way where you're not quite sure, as an actor, what the story's going to be going in. Although he's got a script and the script changes all the time, it's almost like he's able to ignore the fact he has the weight of this giant machine on his back and think completely freely. And so nobody is quite sure how the story's going to end up. He's like a sculptor. And what it ended up as was something with a lot more action than I had imagined going in. Like I said, I thought I'd be there for 3 weeks and I was there for 9 months. But listen, I was thrilled with it. As an actor, sometimes it's all about having nervous breakdowns on screen, and sometimes it's just breaking people's arms and legs and kicking down doors. And for me, it was like a 9-month boot camp. I ended up a lot fitter and stronger than when I started, that's for sure.
Although I can't see any other comparison between them. The other person who does that, who, when people make films with a director, have no idea how it's going to work out, is Woody Allen. The amount of people I've spoken to who have shot a Woody Allen film, and then because the only bits of the script they see are their own bits. But then, literally, at the end of it, don't even know whether they're going to be in the finished film, because he has quite famously shot several movies with entire plot threads and plot strands with very, very major actors who then actually don't end up in the final cut at all.
That may be true, but I can't think that there's anything more in common with Woody Allen and Paul Greengrass's film. They have A's in their name. I mean, Paul is...
Well, obviously, I didn't leap to that particular, but thank you for bringing that up, Jason. Thank you.
But he has a script, obviously. The studio don't finance these giant movies without one. He has Brian Helgeland, who's a fantastic screenwriter. But there's something about the process, and I don't want to pull the curtain back on Oz too much, but there's something about it that is amazingly free and creative. Certainly as an actor, that first day I jumped off the helicopter, the very first take, I walked up to Matt Damon, the cameras were all there, and I delivered some pithy dialogue, I thought, to him, the zingers that were bound to be in the trailer.
Were you just making that up?
Yeah, yeah. And I marched off, and then Paul went, "Yeah, no, mate, that was rubbish." I said, "Why?" He said, "Don't stop and talk to him." And I said, "Well, where should I go?" And he went, "What do you mean, where should I go? Wherever you want. There's no marks." I mean, half of the craft of an actor normally is be able to hit your mark without looking down like Spencer Tracy and deliver pre-written dialogue as if you just thought of it. Well, in Paul's world, he wants authenticity. He will make it exciting and dynamic. He'll make it thrilling. He'll make you on the edge of your seat. With his technique, he doesn't ask you to bring any of that to it. And so every time I thought I came up with something which was, you know, bound to be on the poster, he'd just look at me and suck his teeth and shake his head.
Well, actually, the person to whom that does bear comparison, therefore, is, and I hate to bring this up, is William Friedkin and the induced documentary style of something like French Connection. Because what Friedkin used to do was he would basically tell people in French Connection, he'd say, "Okay, this is where the action is going to happen." And he'd say to the cameraman, "It's going to happen down the end of that street." And he'd tell them basically what it was that they were going to do, and then he'd say, "Right, go and film it." So it looked like a camera crew had arrived and just happened to be filming the stuff as it happened.
That's absolutely right. It's roughly what goes on. Paul came from the world of documentaries. He kind of reinvented, I mean, it sounds very grandiose, this, but certainly redefined the action genre for a generation with those Bourne films. Every other film I've been on is constantly invoking Bourne, and it's because he knows how to put the camera somewhere as if you have just landed there. And it makes you very on your toes as an actor. I mean, and there is a sense of danger in every moment acting, even if it's just people delivering dialogue to each other, a sense of spontaneity. And I don't think you can fake that. I've watched other people try and fake it, and all they're doing is wobbling the camera and going in and out of focus. But they don't have his storytelling skills. And also, everybody on the screen that you don't recognise, the non-actors, 95% of the people on the screen are soldiers just back from Iraq and Afghanistan, or Iraqis, or interrogators, or translators, and they bring, like in United 93, that, you know, the air traffic controllers, they bring a sense of authenticity to the screen that you'll never see anywhere else.
And having spent that amount of time with Special Forces guys, what did you make of them as someone who presumably doesn't spend most of his time hanging out with the SAS?
No, I don't. They were remarkable, and what none of them did was fit my preconceived cliches. You know, some of them liked Iranian cinema, and some of them were, you know, different types of art, and they've all gone and done. I mean, I saw them all last week at the premiere. They, you know, one of them's gone off and been a paramedic, another one's gone to help out in a flood zone somewhere. They all have this sense of public service and commitment to literally to making, not making the world a better place, it makes it sound cheesy, but they want to do something. That none of them are interested in making money for themselves, for instance. Although many of them have been back to Iraq and Afghanistan because they, the thrill of it, the adrenaline of it, is just too addictive, and they've gone back in for private companies who do most of the stuff over there, surprisingly.
Carol Crawford on Twitter, following up on this, is picking up a point that we've, I think, casually just cast aside. Jason, says Carol, loved the blue neck scarf. Nice touch of colour against the drab desert uniform. That's from Carol in Sydney.
Yeah, that was a bit of a cheeky one, because the moustaches are kind of authentic, and Special Forces, one of the reasons that you can tell them apart from normal soldiers is they don't use rank, they call each other by their first name. They customise their look and their weapons, their facial hair. They actually grow big beards and moustaches often in Iraq, so they can pass at a squint in a distance, you know, in a marketplace and stuff. But blue neck scarf, that's a sheerly narcissistic indulgence, and I apologise for it.
I think, to prevent all of this just falling over into a fashion assessment of the film, which I understand, Simon, I understand it's very important.
It's very important.
It's a brilliant film. I mean, I can't tell you how... I'm so thrilled that he did make that call to me, because it's very rare, maybe once every 10 years in a career like mine, that you get to be part of something that you think is not only... It kind of delivers on every level. It's not only entertaining, which is its primary concern, but it gives you something to talk about afterwards.
Well, here's the question, because the central thesis of the film, and Paul talked about this when he was on, central thesis of the film is that essentially they have been given bad information, and the film, in a kind of vaguely conspiracy thriller kind of way, suggests that they have been given bad information knowingly, that the people who are going out searching for weapons of mass destruction are working from information that the people who are providing for them know is wrong. And when Simon asked Paul about it, Paul's response was, he said he didn't think of it as a conspiracy, but he did see it as essentially, as soon as they were there, they understood that what they were doing didn't quite match. And that sense of doubt and that sense underlying what's important about it. So his line about it was effectively he'd made a Bourne movie that had contemporary political relevance. And of course, it was interesting that when we saw the film, we came out and we came
it's
straight
to Chilcot
Inquiry. So the question from your point of view, do you agree with Paul's reading? Because, I mean, I see it as...
Paul is more political and discreet than me, and he's at the centre of the thing. But I can tell
everyone's more discreet than you, Jason.
Yeah, that's true. But surrounding him, he has this extraordinary bunch of researchers and 60 Minutes producers and people who are in as part of the administration, many people who were there in 2003, a lot of journalists. And one of the things, you know, people can like or dislike any piece of work, they can find it entertaining or truthful, however they want, but one of the odd things reading all the reviews, which have by and large been fantastic for this film, is that some people think that it's a kind of bizarre left-wing conspiracy theory, and I have met the people who have told me, who were there at meetings with Iraqi generals and Iraqi scientists who had risked their lives to leave Iraq and have secret meetings with American officials and tell them about WMD, tell them there weren't any WMD, tell them they'd been decommissioned. And the people inside the Bush administration either did not want to hear that or thought they were lying or didn't care and wanted to go in anyway. So the notion that that it was everybody really did believe the WMD and the Bush administration were convinced they'd find them, I think is very far-fetched. I think Paul is being more discreet than needs to be. There's almost nothing in this film, apart from the thrill and structure of it, that is not completely truthful and justifiable.
We'll finish up with Jason. Are you all right, Jason, for another few minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay, well...
I got out of bed at dawn to come here. I'm not leaving.
Okay, good.
He's one of the few people who has nothing to do in Los Angeles in the middle of the night.
Not till 10 o'clock. I've got a costume fitting at 10 o'clock.
What kind of costume is it?
I don't know. I think they want me to wear suits, but I became an actor, so I wouldn't have to wear suits.
Facial hair?
No, I think if I end up being in a TV series for years and years, I certainly don't want to deal with that.
The only reason I'm looking forward to saying goodbye to Jason Isaacs is so I can get rid of this wretched moustache.
Take it off. Rip it off, for God's sake.
Right, that's it. It's coming off.
I tell you what, I felt very butch in Morocco walking around my moustache, but when I got home to Soho, it felt very different, let me tell you.
I've got a bit of stubble, which it's all stuck to now.
I think we should repatriate this hair and send it back to...
Can we do it? Can we give these away for a competition? We were saying earlier...
Can't you use it as a merkin in the next Coen Brothers film?
It said on the piece of card that this came from that it was made with real human hair from Korea, and I find that slightly disturbing.
No, do you know what wigs are made of? I was told for years wigs are made of what they call virgin hair, Goodwin. I was very confused by that. It turns out it means hair that's not been dyed or permed. But for a long time, I thought something else.
Yeah. Okay, right. Well, a little bit more with Jason Isaacs. Tashes are off. Fantastic. Liberation.
Yeah, but you've still got glue on your upper lip, so you've now got a white tash that makes you look like a very old man.
Okay.
I should have come in with a fake quiff on.
Look, this would have worked if you'd been here.
Sorry.
Right, so we'll update you on the chat with Lindsay, then we'll be back with Jason Isaacs and your emails, lots of correspondence to Jason in just a moment. Now, presumably, Jason, you're used to this makeup remover. So this is called Bond-Off Adhesive
Awful.
Remover.
That's why I grew my own moustache. It was absolutely awful. In Morocco, in the heat as well, a nightmare.
I don't know if you checked your Wikipedia page recently, by the way. I don't know if you do that every morning.
No.
But it's got a very useful summary of your education and the films that you've been in. Then it has a little section, personal, at the end, and it says, Jason Isaacs is one of the people, along with David Morrissey, Fairport Convention, who has said hello to every week by Simon.
I think there should be a test. All the people on your list, do they still listen to your podcast? Because
You're almost certainly top of the list, mate.
I would think I am. I was very upset about Matthew Good last week. Was it the week before Matthew Good?
Well, he didn't come in.
And tell him off. Yeah.
Yes. Do you know him?
I do, yeah.
Is he nice?
He's lovely. Very funny, very dry.
Well, he's made a stinker of a film.
Yeah, but I do hold that at least
haven't we all?
At least he had the good grace to not come and pretend it was any good. I mean, that's the point. You know, I mean, actually, he went up in my estimation because clearly he knows that it's clunktastic from beginning to end.
Noah in New Jersey says, I thought I might interest the venerable Mr. Isaacs to know that my mother, formerly Vanessa Layden, was once good friends with his wife and recalls meeting him in Toronto in 1982. Whenever his name appears on some great big poster, she summons up fond memories of having dinner with the acclaimed actor, complete with long blonde hair and noticeably topless for the occasion.
Jason had long blonde hair and was noticeably topless.
Was Vanessa.
Therefore, on behalf of myself and my dear mother, we say hello to Jason Isaacs. Why would, in Toronto in 82, would you have had long blonde hair and nothing on your upper garments? Nothing on your upper torso?
I hadn't met my wife in 1982. And I didn't ever have long blonde hair until Harry Potter paid me to do it.
I knew I'd seen you somewhere before. Colin Elsey in Brooklyn. I was lucky enough to get tickets to the New York premiere of Green Zone a few weeks ago. Afterwards, I mustered up the courage to introduce myself to the wandering around the lobby Paul Greengrass. Makes him sound like some kind of vagrant. Because he does look a bit
He looks like a tramp, let's be honest.
There are a few people in this world who you can tell right away are good, kind people, but Mr. Greengrass is one of them. He was gracious, seemingly genuinely appreciative when I told him how much of a fan I was. After shaking my hand, he made a point to introduce himself to my girlfriend, who was taking a picture of the two of us. It was refreshing to know that such a big Hollywood director can be such a nice man. Also, I looked for but couldn't find Jason Isaacs, to whom I desperately wanted to say hello to, thus leaving another life's goal unfulfilled.
Oh, sorry. Hello, mate. Hope you're listening now. Do you know what? It was a really brutally cold and snowy night that night, and the people who turned out were amazing. They kind of crossed the country to get tickets for this thing, and it was like the day after tomorrow getting there.
Are you prepared for a negative email on this?
Yeah, go for it.
Would that be all right?
They're wrong. I'll tell you right now, they're wrong. It's a brilliant film, but there you go.
It's from Howard Smith.
If that's the best he can do with his name, what would you expect?
Went to see Green Zone last night. Left me feeling distinctly flat. The action was what you would expect, but I really did feel that it was overkill on the handheld camera work, which just became irritating in the extreme. And instead of making me feel like I was in the scene, it made me feel like I was in the sea, sloshing around all over the place. And he has this line, which I've just adapted and changed just a little bit, Jason, for reasons that you'll appreciate. One of the questions that he emerged from the film with he was asking, how can a one-legged man get to a particular place at the same speed as a helicopter, a jeep and a Humvee in the pitch black without so much as a torch?
Because nobody's running in a straight line. They're all running around in circles.
There we go.
Showing the photograph of it. How fantastic. You know what? He's absolutely entitled to his opinion. I'm sorry you had a bad time. Howard, on the other hand, he probably didn't like the Bourne films either, and most of the world loved them.
Well, I'm just trying to balance
up. You look fantastic.
The
pictures of you actually can carry off the moustache, both of you.
Yeah,
don't you think? And I think Mark looks superb. Mark did look like Smithers from The Simpsons, don't you think?
Looks like a South American dictator.
Smithers.
To me.
No, you said like Stalin.
Ordering whole villages wiped out.
One of the things that I think is just worth mentioning about the film, which people see right at the very beginning, is that you talk about it being a left-wing conspiracy. It is quite clear just from this film that when the American troops arrive, right in the early, they are being welcomed. You know, that this is, it's a slightly more nuanced film than some people are making out. When the troops arrive, you know, that they're welcomed at that point.
Look, this film doesn't make a pivotal point. Most of all, this film is a rollicking, big roller coaster of a ride. I mean, that's the most important thing to Paul when he made this story. It's for everyone. And it's for people who like the Bourne films to have a great time. But it certainly doesn't... I don't think it's particularly controversial to say that the Titanic sank or that there weren't any WMD. I mean, anybody who thinks that's some kind of lefty conspiracy is, stuck somewhere in Reagan land. I don't know why they would be doing it. But he makes the experience, you know, he puts you in there. And just, I don't know about you, but I remember at the time I thought there were weapons of mass destruction. I was sure they were going to find these things. Why else would all these people have gone along with it and all the cabinet members and leaders of different countries? And I think he gives us the experience as a viewer that we all had at the time, which we get then we're slightly bewildered and trying to work out what the hell to do. Some people have slightly misinterpreted. The character that Matt Damon plays is a real guy. Things happened to him that didn't exactly happen to the bloke. But his real name is Monty, and he was the head of the WMD unit, and he is Matt Damon's doppelganger. And when people say it's ridiculous that he would go so off reservation, it's exactly what Monty did. He started to investigate the intelligence when the intelligence turned out to be bankrupt.
Well, actually, if there is a political point to be made in the film, beyond the conspiracy thing, I think it's quite clearly it's the role of the press. Actually, funnily enough, that part of the story is made very clear that the press basically go along with the story that they're given without properly checking it.
Yeah.
And at one point, a character crucially says, "We did this, and yes, we were mistaken." And of course, historically, that is pretty much what happened.
Miller, who wrote for the New York Times, they've changed the name and they've changed the newspaper. Some of the people who wanted to criticise it went, "Well, it's ridiculous. It's not even the right newspaper," as if that's the point.
The left-wing conspiracy bit at the end, where you see...
to give the end away, surely.
No, let's just say there is a memo which is sent, and there is a list of people that are copied in, including The Guardian.
Yes, I know.
So there you go. I just thought, clearly, it's left-wing propaganda, Jason.
Exactly.
And you know it. Marius has an interesting theory. Marius is writing from Cape Town, listening live to the programme, which he says, one of the very few addictions I faithfully nurture. This is like the World Service. Is it possible, he says, this is a question, that Jason's jump from the helicopter alludes to a new Bourne movie, given that he actually beat up Matt Damon? So therefore, Jason is tougher than Matt Damon. Therefore, maybe in the next sequence
he
of
will
Bourne
be
movies,
born
Jason
again.
Isaacs
no, but I'll tell you something
born.
About jumping from a helicopter. Obviously, I'd never done it before. I was terrified. The helicopters on screen looked like Black Hawks. When you watch the movie, you feel like you're in Iraq in 2003. In fact, some prestigious New York journalist asked me what it was like shooting in Iraq, which was obviously ridiculous since we were in Morocco. But the actual helicopters they use were Hueys, the kind of 50s and 60s helicopter that America's used in Vietnam, owned by the Moroccan Air Force, held together by a bit of silly putty and sellotape, and I was terrified up there. But you're clipped in by a tiny piece of bungee, you know, kind of a foot-long piece of jump bungee, that's all that's holding you. And as we came in, I know that Paul likes things to move, I unclipped when we were maybe 50 metres off the ground so I could jump off just before we'd landed. And all the soldiers followed suit. And only later, when I got to know them well, did they tell me they thought I was suicidal and insane, and you would never do that. But they all felt they had to follow.
Well, it just shows that you're braver than special forces.
Stupid.
As we approach the 3:30 news report, have we reviewed it? Do you think? Will people?
I think
I think we have.
I mean, yes. If it needs to be done, it's jolly good. It's an exciting Bourne action movie that has, if you want to see it, and I do want to see it, a solid political underpinning, and tells a difficult story in the most mainstream way possible.
It's a thriller with benefits.
Very good. Shame he's in the film, so we can't use it.
Wendy Bevan Mogg says, could you ask Jason about his moustache and flat cap in the film Skeletons, which is coming out in July? It's a British film by first-time director Nick Whitfield and needs mentioning.
It does. It's fantastic. It's coming out in July. It's a beautiful, surreal, whimsical little fable. I can't think of a way to describe it other than you've got to go and see it. It's like Buñuel directing Derek and Clive or something. I don't know what it is. It's Dali makes... Tarantino. Everything is kind of hybrid. It's incredibly funny, incredibly English, and when my agent said, look, there's a film, you won't want to do it, they've got no money, it's not the lead part, they've made a short, and he sent me the link to it, I watched the short and I said, I'm in, and I went and lived in a cottage with the main actors, and which is a tiny crew, and had a fantastic time, not really wondering what the film would be like, just like the experience. Then they had a screening a few weeks ago in London, and I think it's brilliant.
And Paul in Bristol, could you ask Jason if the rumours are true and that he's signed up for Benjamin Snittlegrass and the Cauldron of Penguins?
Absolutely. The Flickr book. Yeah.
Yeah. What, which role would you like in it, if you could choose anything?
Oh, well, I've always wanted to play one of those penguins. In fact, I'd like to play all of the penguins. I'd like to be cloned, like in March of the Penguins. I'd like to see thousands of me huddled against the winter breeze.
Somebody else tweeted a question, which is to ask Jason about his alternative musical career. Do you have an alternative musical?
What? No, I was nearly on...
What's going on?
I was nearly on the Alan Titchmarsh show last week, but I had to leave to go to Chicago, on the same day that my namesake, Jason Isaacs...
Oh!
I don't know if he won or not, but he's in the finals of the crooning thing, which is very odd, because I do keep getting people congratulating me on my performances.
This is it.
Somebody gave us
a leaflet for this. I was on tour, and somebody gave me a leaflet for Jason Isaacs, club singer... And who apparently is king of the swingers, Jason Isaacs.
He's very good.
And he's but he's obviously not you.
No, he's very much not me. I can't sing. I was once offered Guys and Dolls in the West End, and I wondered if it was like the producers. I wondered if they wanted the theatre to close.
You noticed how he just dropped in when I was on tour. Anyway, we finished with this.
No, I tell you what, I've got a confession. I lied to you, Mark. I said I hadn't quite finished the book. Actually, I'd lost the book. And when I came to America, I found it in my suitcase, and I'm loving it.
You're having just
a fantastic time.
Worse than Mayo, who hasn't read the wretched thing.
I didn't want to tell you I'd lost it. It felt rude. But now I've found it, and I'm two-thirds of the way through. I loved Manchester.
I just want to finish with this. From the T5M Entertainment website, Jason Isaacs has confessed it's unbearable getting ready to say goodbye to his Harry Potter role, blah, 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 blah.
True.
Jason, 64, is ecstatic to be making a return.
I know. Well, that's why I need all that makeup, obviously. The goggles and the moustache and anything I can get hold of.
It's on the internet, therefore it must be true. It
must be true.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know what I said? I was at school with him. He was a teacher. That's how that worked.
That's right.
Jason, it's always a pleasure to speak to you, and thank you very much for getting up early, even though you're not here, to appreciate our tash-tastic special
I love it. I've seen the photograph. Thank you for putting it on, and thank you for watching the film, and I look forward to being there in the flesh next time.
Jason, thank you very much indeed. Clint Jones on Twitter here saying, I tuned into your webcam, but it seems to be stuck on footage of a diminished Jason King fan club. Where are you guys? Well, not anymore. It's just us. You can follow us, by the way, on Twitter. Mark barely contributes, but I try and update people every now and again whenever there is any movie-related gossip to pass on.
I see.
Craig says, I took my wife to see Hatchie, which we reviewed earlier.
Yes.
The Richard Gere film.
Yes, which I liked, despite having my heart broken.
She was crying by halfway.
Yeah, exactly.
For the whole of the second half, and when it came up that it was a true story at the end, she started crying again. Next time I'm going to stick to my films, like The Prophet. What a film, says Craig, with the wet shoulder.
There is a thing again in the press notes in which Richard Gere talks about when he got when Richard Gere got the script, he said, it's not a movie that one would expect I would be drawn to, but when I read it, I cried like a baby, and I said, oh man, I'm going to have to do this, aren't I? So I read it again just to be sure, and it really moved. I mean, the fact of the matter is, it is a weepy, but the only problem is whether or not I think taking your wife is probably more sensible than taking your kids.
Can I just say, if you do want to follow us on Twitter, what you do is go to the Five Live website and follow the details from there, and you'll get updates on a spasmodic basis. What do you have?
Shutter Island.
Shutter Island. It's the new Martin Scorsese film.
It is. Are we saying Scorsese or Scorsese at the moment?
I don't think anyone says Scorsese.
When I interviewed Ray Winston, who'd worked with him, he referred to him as Martin Scorsese. And it was Ray Winston, and I wasn't going to argue with
him,
frankly.
What?
He said Martin Scorsese.
That's just... But that must be wrong.
No, it is. It's inaccurate. But fine, put you in a room with Ray Winston, who says, when I was working with Martin Scorsese,
and
you say, oh, sorry, that's not what he said. So anyway, story set in the 1950s. The story, as ripe as anything, based on a story by Dennis Lehan, who, of course, is the guy behind Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone, both of which have been adapted for film. Story is Leonardo DiCaprio is a US Marshal. He's previously in the war. He is sent with a partner, played by Mark Ruffalo, over to the eponymous Shutter Island, which is, in classic B-movie tradition, a strange, enclosed island asylum where incredibly dangerous mad people are kept by a group of equally sinister, clipboard-wielding doctor types. They've been sent over there because one of the patients has mysteriously disappeared from a cell, which is so heavily guarded that it would be impossible for anybody to disappear unless they had help from the inside. But is everything as it seems? Who are the patients? Who are the doctors?
Lots of hand action at the moment.
Let's find out from Sir Ben Kingsley.
Those paintings are quite accurate. Used to be the kind of patients we deal with here were shackled and left in their own filth. They were beaten, as if whipping them bloody would drive the psychosis out. We drove screws into their brains. We submerged them in icy water until they lost consciousness or even drowned.
And now?
We treat them, try to heal, try to cure. And if that fails, at least we provide them with a measure of comfort in their lives, calm.
These are all violent defenders, right? I mean, they've hurt people, murdered them in some cases.
In almost all cases, yes.
And personally, Doctor, I'd have to say screw their sense of calm.
The Leonardo DiCaprio now playing a rather more grown-up role than in the past. Now, a couple of people looking at this film have said, "Oh, well, you know, it's essentially silly," and it is ripe and silly as anything. It's deliberately a sort of a B-movie for it. To some extent, it harks back to the remake of Cape Fear. It has a musical selection which honks and quacks and guffs like a large ferry
coming in.
Well, we've got the second clip, London, just play the beginning of the second clip, which will just demonstrate for you the
soundtrack that quacks.
Except, you know, honking. Here's a little bit of soundtrack.
What is a honking?
Well, listen.
Okay.
Oh, it's not quite there.
It's almost there.
Basically, it's got a soundtrack which says, you know, serious stuff, bad, everything turned up to it. It sounds like a ferry coming into dock on several occasions. It's basically a soundtrack which is... It reminded me, to some extent, of the soundtrack to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Remember the opening of The Shining when you see the VW driving? I mean, Ligeti, obviously, is the connection only with Kubrick. But you see the VW driving on the hills and things go, honk,
we've got the clip.
You got the clip. Oh, here we go.
That's honking.
There we go. Yeah, there's an awful lot of that. So all the way through, the whole tone of the thing is turned up to hysterical, and it reminded me of Shock Corridor, the film by the Sam Fuller movie, Shock Corridor. You seen that?
What?
Shock Corridor, the Sam Fuller movie set in an asylum. Shock Corridor.
Shock Corridor.
Yes. Have you never seen that?
No.
Okay. Have you ever seen the Ninth Configuration?
What happens in it?
They're in a corridor and it's pretty shocking.
It's a shocking corridor. It's a corridor. It's shocking because it just goes on and those double
There's one
doors.
Fantastic scene in Shock Corridor, which is one of those. It's like a movie asylum. And at one point, our anti-hero finds himself inadvertently opens a door and finds himself locked in a room full of women. And the voiceover goes, "Oh no, nymphos." Anyway, it has that ripe quality. Also reminded me of The Ninth Configuration, the William Peter Blatty movie, in which the whole thing about, you know, who's the patients, who's the thing. It's basically, if you know anything about the B-movie conventions of people going to asylums, you'd be really not trying very hard if the whole plot didn't start to unfurl as soon as you get in. But that's one of the joys of it. The other thing is we have Max von Sydow.
Martin Scorsese.
As this very sinister Uber doctor type who probably has some kind of Nazi past. And the whole implication is that the whole thing is being played out in some sort of Boys from Brazil type, like, experiment thing that maybe is an overhanging world or maybe is all entirely in the mind of the protagonist. Who can tell? Now, I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed it on the level of it's completely ridiculous. It's honk, quack, brap soundtrack. It's Leonardo DiCaprio's performance, you know, doing chewing the scenery, where Sir Ben Kingsley doing his most...
Is it better than The Hood?
You know, I was going to say his most Thunderbird-like performance since Thunderbirds. You remember? Actually, I always thought his role in the Thunderbirds movie was perfectly cast because he does look exactly like the puppet of The Hood anyway. But he does that Ben Kingsley thing about being slightly sinister and slightly bald, well, profoundly bald in a sinister way. It reminded me of that thing from With Nail and I where the guy says, yeah, the judge started coming on all bald with me. And I really, really enjoyed it, even whilst thinking this completely ridiculous. ridiculous. It looks the difference between it, of course, and a genuine B movie is that it costs a lot more. It's got much more famous actors. It has much higher production values. It has much more expensive music clearance rights, and the expectations are much higher. But I don't see why Martin Scorsese shouldn't be able to enjoy himself with essentially making a throwaway B movie in the same way that Quentin Tarantino has spent the last portion of his career making what he considers to be grindhouse movies. This is more fun in its pastiche way than the stuff than Death Proof, which Tarantino has done, and I really enjoyed myself even whilst knowing just how ridiculous and silly it is. And when the unexpected twist comes, believe me, if you didn't see it coming, you really aren't trying.
What happens? What's the twist?
Richard Gere dies.
That's a shame. And why is it called Shutter Island? What's the shutter bit?
Well, it's the name of the island.
I know that, but why is it called Shutter Island?
Well, Simon, that's probably part of the mystery.
Is it?
Well, not really. So why is it? Well, it sounds, Shutter Island. That everyone's shut, you're shut in. They're all shut down. They're all locked in. It's an island full of shutters. What do you want?
Simon in Exeter, dear Winnie and Tigger, love the Tashes. I'm a big fan of Dennis Lehane's book, and Martin Scorsese has done a magnificent job transferring Shutter Island to the big screen. Leo's and Sir Ben are on fine form here, and just like his version of Cape Fear, it's a sumptuous homage to the classic noir and gothic horror movies of old.
It is very gothic, and it is, and I think it's a much better movie than Cape Fear, which I didn't like. I thought Cape Fear was ripe in a... I thought Cape Fear was rotten, this is just ripe.
Does gothic tend to honk? Does honk go
It does in
gothic?
This case. Yes. I mean, it is honking. I mean, as it was demonstrated by when we got that clip up, it is like a very large ocean liner coming into a very small... And it's brilliant because in the opening sequence, it's like the music starts doing that, and then it proceeds to do that for the whole of the rest of the movie. I mean, Scorsese has obviously got his entire record collection. He just went through it. Okay, what can we get that sounds like, like a big steam paddle going up the... What have you got that's got... Okay, fine, they can do all that stuff. Let's put all that, anything that's honking, let's put that on.
My 10-year-old is doing similes and metaphors at school at the moment, and I think we've just done a fantastic, it's cheese, it's like a cheese, it's sort of gothic, it's honking.
Who said cheese?
You said cheese.
Did I say cheese?
Honk and cheese and gothic.
I don't remember saying cheese.
It's been a simile.
But it is
fest.
Cheesy. That's it is it definitely. Is. But what I said was that the Cape Fear is rotten and this is just ripe. I mean, the ripeness it is a ripe cheese in as much as it. Yes, it is. It's ripe and high and smelly.
But on its way to rotten.
On its way to rotten, but not yet there. Rotten. Yes. It's mouldering without having actually gone rancid.
Enough. Like a mature Stilton.
Very good.
It's a mature Stilton of a movie.
Lindsay, straight to the point. Which brings us. To
The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
And this from Nicola in Aston Abbots.
Yes.
I went to a screening of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo at the Rex, Berkhamsted. Wonderful. I thought it was very odd. 1 minute art house, the next murder, she wrote. One scene shocking, the next cheesy and awkward. Something was lost in translation. This is what Dr. K thinks.
It's a very difficult thing to sum up because it is a movie of several different parts. Part of the Millennium Trilogy by the late Swedish author Stieg Larsson, and the rest are coming. It's already, a European box office hit. The story, which is a complicated story, is that a guy who is about to go to prison for a libel offence is enlisted by a rich man to investigate an apparent crime from ages and ages ago, which is the disappearance of his niece from a very long time ago, disappeared, I think it's 40 years ago. And ever since her disappearance, little clues have been turning up that suggest that the killer is taunting the person who is getting in our detective to go and find out what's going on. In order to solve the crime, he enlists the help of a computer hacker. And there are autobiographical details which link all the protagonists through strange and labyrinthine twists to various parts of the plot and indeed to each other. Now, I think that's what was meant when he said sometimes it's murder, she wrote. There's that sense about, oh, so-and-so is connected to so-and-so and is connected to so-and-so. The first thing I think that's important to say about this film is that there are moments in it that are very tough. It has an 18 certificate from the BBFC, and as you probably know, it's quite hard nowadays to get an 18 certificate. It tends to be something which is handed out to films which are sexually violent. Just to read you this very briefly, it says in the BBFC's 18 certificate rating that there are, referring to the scenes of sexual violence, that they are extremely aversive and strong. They go beyond what's acceptable at 15, which is clearly the case. However, they are placed appropriately in the adult category that their representations fail to challenge the BBC's overarching principle that, quote, content which might eroticise or endorse sexual violence may require cuts. So essentially what they're saying is this material is tough. It in no way eroticises the material that it's dealing with, but it is tough. It is 18 certificates tough. And certainly there were, I have to confess, moments during the sexually violent scenes in which I felt very uneasy. I never felt that the film was leery or eroticising. I agree with the BBFC decision, but certainly I felt that they went as far as I wanted them to go, if not somewhat further. So I think it is important to say, if you're going to go and see The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, do be prepared. I know we become very inured to this stuff, but do be prepared for the fact that some of the material is really tough going, and some of the material is really hard. And I've seen a couple of reviews in which I don't think it's quite been flagged up enough just how tough it is. Beyond that, there is an awful lot to admire in the film. It has a sort of a sense of downbeat miserabilism, which on the one hand is very exciting. On the other hand, gives you a gritty sense of real people confronting real problems, really dealing with really horrible, really unpleasant stuff. It is clearly a dark work from beginning to end, and it clearly heralds, more darkness to come, which I think is great. Somebody had written in to say, should I see it with subtitles or in a dub version? I haven't seen a dub version. When I saw it, it was subtitled, and obviously I would always recommend seeing something subtitled. The only time I would make an exception to that is when we're talking about certain animations in which I think there is an argument for subtitling for dubbing animations, because it's not, because you're essentially what you're doing is voicing the cartoons anyway. It's a rather different thing. So I was very impressed by The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I haven't read the book, and I think that if you had read the book, it might be a slightly different experience. But I understand it. It's interesting that you read out that email, because I shared many of the same emotions, that it does seem like a game of several parts. And there are gear changes in it and shifts in it and moments in it in which, because its extremities are quite so extreme, because when it's graphic, it's quite so graphic, because when it's twisty and intertwined on itself, it's quite so twisty and intertwined on itself. There are moments in which it seems to fit together somewhat awkwardly. It's certainly not a movie with smooth corners. It is a movie with ragged edges. It is a movie of, of ideas and a challenging concept and creaky plot mechanisms all rammed together in a way that sometimes gels perfectly, but occasionally seems perhaps more raggedy than would necessarily be a good thing. It does have some very, very fine performances in it, and I think overall, I think it's a really interesting film. But I would say this: be careful. It's a tougher movie than perhaps people are giving the impression of.
We talked about The Shirt of Hurt earlier.
You weren't listening to any of that, were you? You're only interested in The Shirt of Hurt.
No, we're just moving on. It's my job. You rabbit on and you do your thing, and then when you stop, I pick it up and we move on to the next thing.
Shirt of Hurt.
Shirt of Hurt. Steve, on this, surely The Good Doctor should wear a Pirates of Caribbean shirt? That would be quite good.
Okay.
How about I Love 3D, It's the Future?
That would hurt, I'm not going to wear that.
For sport relief.
Okay.
Mark would have to wear a Chris Columbus on one side and Michael Bay on the other shirt.
I know, the Michael Bay, that would be the shirt of hurt. That would be the shirt that really hurts.
I love Michael Bay in 3D. That'd be great. We should say, by the way, while there's time, next week, because we always like to change things round, we can't be on at the same time, week after week.
No, next week, was it Racing from Chilcot? Racing from Cheltenham. No,
Racing from the Chilcot Inquiry. That's right. What we're doing is we're getting all the members of the government and all the army top brass who've given evidence, and the judges,
yes,
all the inquisitors, we're putting them on horses, and whoever gets to the finishing line first, that's the one we believe.
That's the one. Okay.
That's right. It's Racing from Chilcot.
Sorry.
And whoever comes last in that race gets the blame for everything. So we're on next week from 12 until 1. We have 1 hour. You're in America. I'm going to be here.
Okay.
Next week's with entertainment from 12 o'clock. Thank you. You look as though you're poised
to
deliver.
Can I mention the Kreutzer Sonata very quickly?
Well, how quickly is it going
to
be?
Well, it's going to have to be quite quick.
Well, Kreutzer Sonata. I've got an entertaining email as
well. Okay, you go ahead and then I'll do... No, let me do this quickly. Okay. Kreutzer Sonata, new movie by Bernard Rose, based on the novel by Leo Tolstoy, starring Danny Houston. Basically, a tale of rampaging sexual jealousy played out against a piece of music which can either be seen as sublime or hellish, depending on the perspective of the listener. Bernard Rose, very fine director, he's probably probably best known, I suppose, for Candyman. Recently, Ivan's XTC. Clearly somebody who understands Tolstoy and how to make Tolstoy work on the screen in a modern way. Watched this yesterday, was really very gripped by it, thought it was a director doing exciting, interesting stuff, and Danny Houston going completely bananas, totally over the top, sexual jealousy. Perhaps not everybody's night out, but I liked it very much.
Tim in Cardiff, I've just been to a screening of Green Zone. Fantastic and thought-provoking film, as expected. It's inspired me to grow a Jason Isaacs moustache and start punching people first and then asking questions. Matt Damon has fought in the Civil War, the Second World War, now the Iraq War. Could you ask Dr. K whether this makes him this generation's John Wayne?
It does. It does, definitely.
And Kevin in Slough, Dr. Kermode's Shirt of Hurt slogan, I love Bono and you two are clearly superior to the Comsat Angels. And Michael Bay.
That would work. I'm not even going to rise to that.
Movie of the week.
Green Zone.
Indisputably.
Yeah. Indubitably.
Indubitably, indeed. Thank you very much indeed for listening. We're back next week. Just a reminder, we've changed it because of Racing from Chilcot. It's from 12 till 1 for your entertainment next week. Have a fantastic week.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.